Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And my guest today, Andrea Batista Schlesinger, is quite comfortable providing all the news the government does not want you to know. She's been doing it for some time. She's the executive director of the Drum Major Institute, which is a progressive think tank. Frankly, I don't think we have enough progressive think tanks in Washington. We hear all about the Heritage Foundation, but there aren't too many that are coming in there and opposing the government. And they've issued a report, an end-of-the-year report, focusing on 2004. And what's interesting to me about this report is it gives all those dry statistics. It really brings them to life in a way that we can understand the ultimate question, are we better off? Are we better off with George W. Bush as president economically and in all other kinds of ways than we were 4 years ago? Let me read to you a little bit from that report. The report says that when 2004 began, there were 35.8 million Americans living in poverty, 1.3 million more than the year before. Think about it. 1.3 million more than the year before. That's up 5% in just a year, 2004, that I thought was a year where conditions were improving. More than 45 million Americans without health insurance, 1.5 million more than the year before. More than 3 million out-of-work Americans had exhausted their federal unemployment insurance benefits. Bankruptcy has claimed more American families than the year before than had divorce. Well, that's pretty grim statistics. But, hey, you know, the report points out some good news, too. CEOs are doing very well. In fact, they're now making more than 400 times the average American worker. Think about it. The average American worker can earn just as much as a CEO per year if they work 400 years. Taxes collected from the nation's top 1% have declined. While the middle class pays more, we can be thankful that those multimillionaires are doing better off than they ever were before. So when we bring these statistics to light, when you're talking with one of those misguided Americans, and there must be a few of them out there because he appears to have won this election, when you're talking to one of those misguided Americans that pulled the lever for George W. Bush, do you have the statistics do you need? I mean, they're going to tell you the economy's better off. One of the things the Democrats, I think, did pretty well in the election, at least they pointed out that there are less jobs now than when George W. Bush became president. But there's a lot more than that, and I want to focus today on the middle-class squeeze, on the economic insecurity that seems to be growing in America, and give it faces and names and statistics so that you know really what to say when you're making this argument. Hopefully we won't have too dry a discussion. There's also, of course, a lot to talk about. This is the year-end show in 2004. Of course, there's the war in Iraq. Talked about seems ad infinitum, but maybe that's because it's a war that's going on without end. The torture there, the secrecy in our government, the media and how it seems to be increasingly controlled by the right wing. Of course, there's all kinds of questions about the economy. There's questions about our voting systems. And any question you want to ask, we're ready to take it on. Ms. Schlesinger and I, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can contribute to the blog, as so many of you already have, by going to www.radioinsidescoop.com. Ms. Schlesinger, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Now, your organization, tell me a little bit about it. I probably should have heard of the Drum Major Institute, and I apologize. Why don't you explain to our listeners who you are, how long you've been around, things like that?
Sure. Well, contrary to some who call, we do not offer drum lessons.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I could have a pretty thriving side business. you know, we call ourselves a think tank that could, which is maybe why you haven't heard of us. We were founded initially during the Civil Rights Movement by Harry Wachtel, who was a lawyer and an advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King, and was part of a group of lawyers here in New York that were funneling legal assistance and fundraising support to the movement and played an important role in the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
Interesting. So you've been around a long time, 40-odd
years.
We
have been, but there was a long period of inoperation, I should say. And, you know, after Dr. King was killed, a lot of the organizations that were created at that time, like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were leaderless and were, you know, focusless. And so there was a long period of inoperation until 1999 when Harry's son Bill, also a lawyer concerned with social and economic justice here in New York, decided to restart us and, you know, as he says, kind of set the beat for the new millennium, which is what a drum major does, which is where that language comes from.
I had to ask. I mean, I had to figure that out. It's so we're setting the beat for a new generation.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. King would talk about the drum major instinct of what it means to not need to be the star, what it means to just slowly but surely set the beat for others to join in, and that's the idea. And 3 years ago, Fernando Ferrer, who was a policymaker here in New York, came on as president and asked me to come on with him. And, you know, the idea was to turn this explicitly into a think tank for the left.
Well, what's very interesting you have a very good report, and I've flipped through it, and I would encourage others to do so. You just go to www.drummajorinstitute.org, all one word, Drum Major Institute. And it really, you take statistics, and statistics are often dry and they often bore people, but when you draw it out as you have, just by giving by the numbers, there's really some amazing stuff here that I guess I hadn't realized it was as bad as it was. Two in five low and middle income, not just low income, but low and middle income black high school students cannot go to college because of financial barriers. That surprised me. Two in five can go. In other words, they have the grades. They just can't go because of money. And, of course, you bring up statistics about how much CEOs earn versus how much the average worker earns. How much of all this inequality, this growing inequality, can we pin on the Bush administration? How much of it is just part of American history?
Well, I think a lot of it is a legacy of discrimination in this country. I mean, certainly when you talk about wealth and the disparities in wealth, which is for the most part passed down from generation to generation, which is why African Americans are less likely to own homes and more likely to foreclose on their homes. When you start to look at some of those issues, including disparities, for example, in wages, then it's obvious that that's not tied to the policies of any one administration, but an ongoing legacy. The question is, have we created policies that have made things better or worse? And what our report, tries to do is show how often, and especially this year, there are so many contradictions when we talk about this country. And so, for example, we talk about, equal opportunity for education, and that was certainly a key part, education, of the president's reelection campaign. But, public higher education tuition went up 14% last year.
Let me ask you a broader statistic, and I didn't see it right away, but let me see if you have it on your fingertips. What percentage of Americans all across the country who are qualified to go to college cannot go for financial reasons?
I don't have that at my fingertips. I don't know generally, but I only know that it is significantly harder for African American and Latino students, almost half of whom forego, the opportunity to go to college because of cost.
Now, is it true, in fact, that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer? I mean, whenever I hear the Bush administration talk about the economy, they say, hey, growth was up 4%, and,
right,
maybe even average income. I don't know. Average, of course, is a funny word, because you can have four people in a room, and if Bill Gates walks in the room, suddenly the average income of everyone has gone up millions. So average is obviously a very careful term to use, but are average incomes going up, or maybe I should say median incomes going up? Or
here's what we know. Expenses are going up. Incomes are not. We know that jobs, we just went through a major period of unemployment in this country. We know that the jobs that are replacing the jobs that were lost pay less. We know that a significant percentage of Americans are underemployed. We know that the cost of everything from college to heating oil to child care to health care are going up. So when wages are stagnant and when expenses go up, obviously everyone except for the very wealthy is losing. And, in terms of poverty is more entrenched than ever. I mean, the people who began the 90s poor were more likely to end the decade poor than in decades previous.
And are people working longer to get to the same income?
Absolutely. We not only have extraordinarily long work hours, but at the same time we have policies from the federal government this last year to cut overtime, which can be a significant portion of middle-class families' income.
Now, here's something that surprised me, because I've done several shows on the overtime, and it was shocking to me that overtime, which is something that every American knows what it is, every American, many of us have jobs that include overtime, those of us that don't had jobs at one time, perhaps when we began work, that include overtime, everyone knows what this is, and yet when the Bush administration cuts overtime, you would think that'd be a huge national story, and yet I saw more on Swift Boat veterans than I saw on this. Why is that? Why isn't the media covering this basic economic story? Is it just too complex for them, or is there something more nefarious going on here?
Well, I think to some extent it's up to progressives to make the argument, but not only The same voice is making it, but new voices making it. And so that's, for example, why we look at policy through the lens of its impact on the middle class, to say, hey, you know, this is more than just a policy. This is about families. And I think, you know, what the left has not done for too long is to make the connection between public policy and the quality of people's lives. And so there are people who understand vaguely that something is happening in Washington, but they don't necessarily understand how it's going to affect their pocketbook. And they don't understand that the people that they have hired, you know, voted in, but really hired to represent them, aren't doing so. We have not restored that equation so people get it. And that is where we lose when it comes to, you know, changes, for example, in policies around overtime.
Now, let me give out the phone numbers for anyone who wants to join in this discussion. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can contribute on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Mitch Schlesinger, when I make these arguments, and I'm constantly debating Republicans and conservatives both on this radio show and in public gatherings, and when I mention, hey, you know, the poor are getting poorer, the middle class is squeezed, and it's all going to the top 1%, I get turned around, class warfare. You're just trying to have class warfare, and who here wouldn't want their taxes lowered? And, you know, that often makes an audience cheer. How do you explain to the average middle class person that, yeah, you may be getting $100 tax cut, but the fact that someone, a multimillionaire, is getting $100,000 tax cut actually harms you? Why is it that giving all this money away to rich people harms the middle class if the middle class is getting 50 or 100 bucks that maybe, you know, they want?
Sure. Well, this is part of, you know, why I cringed when Kerry looked into the camera and said, I will not raise taxes on the middle class. What the left has to do is something that we did a long time ago very well, which is explain the role of taxes in our lives. And again, this is about making the connection between policy and between people's lives. We need to explain that tax cuts leave state governments starved. And that when state governments are starved, they have to make tough decisions. And so they look at the only things that they can to raise the money that they need. So they look at higher education systems, which is why, you know, you have a 14% increase in higher education, public higher education tuition last year. They look at property taxes, which is why property taxes went up in 108 major cities in 2003. They look at fees and they look at fines. And, you know, I mean, that is the way we see tax cuts for the wealthy manifesting, really, in, you know, on the kitchen tables of middle-class families. So instead of saying, well, the larger tax cut message I have a problem with, but I'm not going to increase taxes on the middle class, we miss an opportunity to have a broader conversation about the role that taxes play in providing the services from roads to schools that the middle class in particular relies on.
Well, I think that a lot of Americans say, well, the tax money, it all sort of goes to Washington, and then afterwards we never really know where it's spent. And a lot of it is wasted. I mean, look at some of the omnibus spending bills where you have all this money going to the Wild American Shrimp Initiative and to put rainforests in Iowa and all the pork that, frankly, the Republicans seem to love these days. And yet somehow Democrats get tarred as the tax and spenders. I mean, how do you change this whole image in the American mind? Obviously, you weren't pleased with how John Kerry did it, and in hindsight, it's easy to say he failed, given that we didn't win the election. But what could he have done better to make this argument?
Well, I think he needed to make the argument that taxes play a role in people's lives. I think he needed to go to states that have, you know, raised public higher education tuition as much as 28% and said, look, this is a direct result of tax cutting on, you know, with a majority of the benefits going to the very wealthy. This is directly impacting you. You know, in terms of how you win politically, I don't know that you can shift the perception that the right has worked on for the last three decades, that government is inherently bad. You know, we define progressive here when we call ourselves a progressive policy institute. We say progressive means that government can play a positive role in people's lives. You know, we have to shift the perception back that, you know, that government is the enemy, and it's going to take longer than one presidential election to do it.
I mean, you have the President of the United States actually talking seriously about ending Social Security, and people are like, well, I don't know, I guess we could end Social Security. It's amazing to me that there's not a stronger backlash.
Right.
And I think part of it is this belief. I mean, I think the Republicans really, it goes back to Ronald Reagan, have been offering America something for nothing, and a free lunch for a long time, and it's called big, big deficits. And here's the idea. We'll say we want to cut taxes and spending, but in essence, we're just going to cut taxes for very wealthy people, and we'll give a little trickle down, 100 here, 200 here to the middle class, and we're going to keep increasing spending for corporate welfare and giving contracts to Halliburton and so forth, and we'll make future generations pay the bill. But if I'm sitting at home and I say, oh, my income taxes went down $100 behind my property taxes, even local officials for those kinds of things, it's very hard to make that kind of connection.
Sure, but we've got and this is one of the things that, you know, we talk about in this year in review report, where 2004 was such a mess of contradictions because you had often Republican local legislators filling in where the federal government would not. And, you know,
filling in with what? With what? With taxes?
For example, with progressive steps. So, for example, you know, governors of three states setting up websites so that their residents, you know, can purchase prescription drugs from Canada. We've got to leverage those local legislators who understand the sets of, you know, the choices that they have had to make to work with what federal policy has given them or not given them. And we've got to leverage, you know, what they are doing to explain the relationship between policy and people's lives.
Let me go to the phones, and I want to hear from our listeners what you think the Democrats could have done, should have done differently to win this election, to explain to the average American how these kinds of statistics and tax policies, and sometimes it can be dry, but it really does affect their lives. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Andrea Batista Schlesinger.
This is Alice Fetlin from Humboldt County.
Hello, Alice. How are you?
Years old.
Well, you're doing very well for 90 years old.
Yeah.
What's your question or comment for our guest?
Do you believe this is all part of the Bush and the plan?
The idea.
Maybe I'm not pronouncing that right.
But you mean the idea to squeeze the middle class? Is that your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
They don't care about us. They only care about the very rich.
And your question is this intentional or is it just happened to happen? Well, okay, it's a fair question. Thank you very much for your call, Alice. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Schlesinger, is this intentional? Is the Bush administration trying to squeeze the middle class or is this an unintentional outcome of their policies?
I don't know that it's helpful to talk about whether or not it's intentional because I think we lose public support when we do, when we frame this as a conspiracy to gauge or to disenfranchise. I think it is more helpful to say, listen, this approach is not going to benefit you, but we know which policies do. We know that this country created a middle class consciously. The middle class didn't just appear, just like the middle class squeeze didn't just appear. Both were the result of public policy. And, you know, the middle of the last century was the result of labor protections. It was a priority of government to work with the private sector to ensure that there were good jobs for people so that middle-class families, you know, could send their kids to school, take care of their elderly parents, and, you know, make sure they could retire. And the middle-class squeeze isn't an accident. It's the result of policies that have left state government starved and, you know, that have ignored key concerns of the middle class. It is all the result of public policy. And I think it is more helpful to talk about public policy that supports everyone who isn't rich than it is to ascribe motives to the right.
Fair enough. I'll tell you, there used to be a time in American history when people could rely on their pension for retirement, could rely on health care from their employers, could rely on Social Security. And now George Bush wants to let us own it all ourselves, which is another way of saying, folks, you got to foot the bill for all of this, and you don't have that kind of security. And yet, I don't know, some Americans seem to be buying it. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. We're going to go to commercial break, and when we come back, we'll hear more from the executive director of the Drum Major Institute, Andrea Batista Schlesinger. More right after this.
Thanks. Hey, by the way, how was the doctor the other day?
Good, but my cholesterol's 200. It's a little high.
Yeah, I'm around 760.
760? You're kidding me.
Pretty impressive, huh?
No, not impressive. Not impressive at all. What are you on, some sort of butter diet?
Yeah, you know, I figured at 760, getting a loan on the new car should be no problem.
Loan? What are you talking about, man? You're not going to live long enough to pay back a loan.
There's physical health, and then there's financial health. With Score Power from Equifax, you'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for just $14.95. It's the first step toward healthy credit, and a score of 760 is pretty healthy. So check out Score Power at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Yeah, I figure I can get up to around 790 by the end of the year, you know, if I'm lucky.
Look, a little more power at Equifax.com.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When its label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec? Nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most. Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get Score Power from Equifax.com. Score Power gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get Score Power at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. Score Power.
Find them at www.drummajorinstitute.org. It is a progressive think tank organization. The average $69 a week. What is the percentage of the $53 trillion debt carried by the average American household? $473,000 and change. And what is the percentage of Americans that argue about money-related topics on a regular basis? 95%. Clearly, there is a middle-class squeeze in this country. John Edwards, vice presidential candidate, talked about two Americas. Clearly, John Kerry tried to position himself as the candidate to help end this or at least lower this middle-class squeeze, and yet we find that the majority of the middle class appears to have voted for George W. Bush. What is going on here? Why aren't the Democrats getting their message out? What are they doing wrong? Are they not being progressive enough? Should they offer their own middle-class tax cuts in response? I want to hear from you. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-5COOP. And I'm also going to be addressing these questions to the executive director of the Drum Major Institute. Her name is Andrea Batista Schlesinger. Ms. Schlesinger, these facts, they seem pretty much beyond dispute, and yet the people aren't getting them, are they?
Well, you know, I am leery of this divide that I think progressives are creating between us and them when, you know, part of, I think that is to some extent why we're in this situation in the first place, where too often people do not think that those on the left speak to them or speak about their struggles respectfully. And so, you know, I think what we need to do is to figure out how to talk about the situation and the reality of their lives, but with an understanding that maybe they do want opportunity. Maybe they do want to own a piece of society. Maybe that message does resonate with them. But we just need to show them how the policies of the right aren't going to get them to where they want to be.
Okay, well, what would get us? I mean, obviously, helping people own their own homes, giving people the chance to go to college, these are all ways to help individuals I mean, I found it amazing that when Bush didn't increase Pell Grants to the level of the population and, in fact, decreased the eligibility for kids to go to college, there was not a huge outrage that I heard anywhere. Again, there was much more talk about Tria Heinz-Kerry saying shove it than there was about the fact that, Americans are not as able to go to college as they used to. So how do we get across this message without, you know, people saying, oh, well, you're just like Jesse Jackson. You just want to, you know, you want to rile up the masses.
Well, as soon as I figure out the, you know, the formula for getting that, I'm definitely going to translate.
Yeah, let me know, will you? Because I got to tell you, a bunch of people really want to find the answer.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate, you know, the humility of, you know, being an expert without all the answers. I don't have them.
It's going to take a long time. And, you know, I face this a lot running a think tank where, you know, we try to get funding and support for people. And they say, well, what are you going to be able to do by the end of this year? I want to know where my money goes.
Yep.
And I have to say to them, listen, I'm not feeding children or planting trees. We're trying to change the frameworks in which we view policy. We're trying to change public will. And that takes a long time. The question is the left and are the powers that be in the left, you know, and I'm talking both about, you know, foundations that determine a lot of where philanthropic money goes. I'm talking about, you know, those other movers and shakers. Are they going to be winning people who are aspiring elected officials and getting them on board with the messages that we know resonate and connecting them to those who are already in office, who have been actually been able to put their values into practice successfully? You know, those are the things that we're... And so my major thing is, you know, I don't know that we figured it out. I know that it requires both uniting good ideas with good messengers, and we have to pay attention to both. But what it really is going to take is a long-term investment in shaping the way we think about these core issues. The question is the left going to be patient enough?
Well, I'll tell you, I do think we're real allies in this process. When I came on air on the radio a year and a half ago, this was before Air America, and I say the majority of Americans preferred Al Gore over George W. Bush. What about this half of America? And they'd say, liberals, they don't listen to talk radio. They listen to jazz. They listen to NPR. Sorry. You know, and it really does require to change a mindset of people to, you know, we have the Fox News propaganda channel, but we don't have anything like that on the left. And I think that the media does have a lot of blame. You have, you know, fair to both sides, but we don't have those institutions. Go to the phones, if I could. Oh, you have a comment before I go to the phones?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the things that we were actually interested in here at DMI is in how, you know, New York City newspapers cover the budget crisis after 9/11, since we were in a major fiscal crisis here. And it was a lot of these same decisions that we're talking about nationally, you know, what helps get economies moving again? Is it tax cuts? Is it tax increase? You know, and we covered the way the four major daily newspapers, including the New York Times, covered the budget. And what we found was, you know, for every four times that they mentioned the position of somebody in power, some kind of a leader, whether it was the mayor or a union leader or something, there was only one mention of the impact of what those stakeholders' positions would be on people. And that is part of where the disconnect comes from, is that the media covers too often, I'm talking about mainstream media, covers a lot of this as a soap opera, you know, a melodrama between people and power, instead of actually explaining what the impact of those decisions are.
And I think a lot of that, I have to say, seem to say Kerry's 1 point ahead, Bush is 2 points ahead, than to say, here's the Kerry health care plan. It provides for you to have health care if you buy into the system. It costs so much, and people start falling asleep. I mean, how do we make these issues sexy? I think that's the ultimate question. Let me go to the phones. If you want to call in, it's 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Andrew Batista Schlesinger.
Yes, this is California Dave, Mark.
Hello, California Dave.
Yes, I am of the belief, am I saying the right Andrea, is that?
Yes, it's Andrea Schlesinger, yes.
That to solve any problem, we have to see it as clearly nice people. They care about other people. They are considerate, thoughtful. They don't like to confront and risk wounding the other person's ego. And reality, I think, of what we're up against, they made it as difficult as possible for Democrats to vote, and then they made it as many as possible vote on machines that were rigged, and that is reality. So it's not a matter of getting a message out. I believe had they not done all of that, Democrats would have won almost everywhere. and by a significant margin. So that's the reality we have to look at. To just talk about nice messages and not offending their egos is...
claims that he actually was asked to rig software by Republican officials. I mean, if we don't have a right to...
Well, I think it's going to take, again, you know, a whole lot of focused inquiry. I mean, there are two problems here. One is the fact that we've got policies that inhibit voting, from the disenfranchisement of felons, you know, to what this gentleman, I'm forgetting his name now, is talking about, you know, in terms
Dave.
Of the potential, Dave, of Reagan, California Dave, right, in terms of, you know, possible corrupt activities. But then, you know, there's an issue that even those who voted only came out, you know, one and two. Even those, you know, who could vote, I mean, the numbers are so low. And so the question is, why aren't more people voting? So you have to address those two things.
Well, I would say as to the latter point that part of that has got to do with the Electoral College. I mean, there is an incentive to vote if you live in Ohio or Florida. But if you live in New York, California, Texas, or Utah, there really isn't that much of an incentive to vote. I would bet that we would increase our numbers from 50% to 70% simply by abolishing the Electoral College. I don't know if you agree with me there.
Well, we are definitely, and we've actually thought about exploring, you know, the way in which the Electoral College, you know, disempowers minority voters because, you know, large cities are come later when they're less relevant. And, you know, these are things that we're interested in exploring for sure. But I do think that it's more than an awareness of an Electoral College that keeps people from voting.
Dave, any last comments? I hear you. I think you turned a computer on there. Anything else you want to say?
It comes on every once in a while. But, yes, do you agree that this if we're up against the reality that I'm perceiving, we've got to call that as it is. If we minimize it, we'd fail to address it.
In other words, if people are actually rigging our votes, the Democrats should be yelling and screaming.
All over that we should be. That's nothing else matters if they're doing that to us. It's not a matter of how better we can sell our message. We got to deal with that reality.
Mitch Schlesinger, has the Drum Major Institute focused on voting rights and specifically on some of the more recent allegations of using the machines to actually rig the vote count?
We haven't. Although this year being the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, participation to the policies that we know work, like same-day registration, and figuring out what kind of support there is to make those policies a reality in every state.
Well, perhaps Dave and I can together implore you to look into some of these things, particularly if you don't support fraud. You know, if I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, if you simply want a fair election, there's no reason to oppose this kind of legislation. And it would certainly make people like Dave and me feel better to know that our elections are fair. Even if we lose one, at least it'd be nice to know for sure, same as what we've seen previously. And is there any good news for the future? It seems that all progressives have to say, including myself, it turns out to be bad news. Hopefully you can provide us for a little bit of good news for the future, but you're going to have to wait till after the commercial break. If you want to dial in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, and we'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Here's a message about Anderson Windows from J.T. Hurst & Company, a division of T.W. Perry. If you're thinking about remodeling your home, keep in mind that windows play a big part, so it's important to get the right ones. Anderson not only offers finely crafted windows and patio doors in thousands of sizes and styles, they also give you natural wood interiors, low-maintenance exteriors, and long... The pros at J.T. Hurst can locate a contractor to do the job for you or give you some helpful tips on how you can do it yourself. J.T. Hurst, a division of T.W. Perry. On Catoctin Circle in Leesburg, Anderson Windows. Long live the home.
How many different organizations list you as a member? You might be a member of a sports team, a book club, traveler CD club. But what does that membership really mean? Does membership in a book club allow you to vote on who runs the organization? Can you help shape the long-term future of your CD club? I don't think so. You can, however, shape the future of your electric company. That is, if you're a Novec customer. NOVEC, Northern Virginia Electric Cooperative, is owned by the consumers we serve and governed by a board of directors elected from the membership. Pretty cool, huh? But wait, there's more. NOVEC's customers share in the company's profits. Last year, we distributed more than $9.1 million in capital credits to our membership. The power to vote and a share of the profits. Membership doesn't get much better than this. NOVEC, locally based and member-owned. For a list of customer services, answers to your questions.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800. Explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. Here are some statistics from the Drum Major Institute. You can find them at www.drummajorinstitute.org. It's a progressive think tank. We have know that Martha Stewart, for example, lied to investigators about the sale of $228,000 worth of ImClone stock. She got 5 months in prison, and many felt that that was too much. And yet, the mandatory sentence for a first-time offender in New York for possessing $20 worth of drugs? 1 to 3 years. The number of American households that possess zero or negative net financial assets? 1 in 3. Here are statistics that I don't think the average American is following, but I want to thank Executive Director Andrew Batista Schlesinger, my guest today, for bringing these kinds of things to our attention. Mr. Schlesinger, one of the things that I have noticed, though, is when even the fact that you call yourself a progressive think tank and don't use the word liberal anymore suggests to me that maybe the conservatives are winning somewhat in the semantics games.
Well, I think using the word progressive is a positive thing. And again, we define progressive as meaning that government can play a positive role in people's lives. That's the tradition of, you know, what it means to be progressive in this country. And that's the model we are attempting to follow.
Is there much difference, though, between liberal and progressive? I mean, liberal has a fine tradition, liberalism, free thought, and human rights and freedom, but that word seems to have gotten quite a bashing lately.
That's true. And whether or not, you know, has the right one out when it comes to messaging liberalism, absolutely. Do I think that, you know, for those for whom liberal has a bad connotation, will they gravitate to progressive? You know, probably not. I think if the right has gotten to them on what that means and on, you know, making liberal a bad word, I'm not sure that progressive is going to pass muster either. The question is, beyond semantics, how have we framed the issues that have led Americans to move right and to see government as more of an obstacle instead of an enabler? And those are the issues that I think we need to work on.
Well, let me ask you, in terms of the Democratic Party framing its message, Howard Dean wants to run for Democratic Party chairman. And Howard Dean is an interesting figure because many Democrats praise his spunk. We heard from a couple callers talking about how the Democrats really should confront the Republicans. I guess Dave may be right about some Democrats. I've never personally been one to be afraid to confront. I'm not necessarily – I mean, I could be polite, but certainly I've challenged my Republican guests with some tough questions. Howard Dean is a confrontational guy, and yet he – a lot of people give credit to bringing the spunk back in the Democratic Party, letting Democrats be Democrats, as Paul Wellstone used to say. Do you think we need more leaders like Howard Dean, or do you think we need to move to the middle – to try to capture that 2% that we need to win elections?
Well, I should first of all say that the Drum Major Institute is nonpartisan. And
okay.
So,
well, let's get away from Howard Dean and just talk about, do you think it's best to make a message that appeals to the progressive principles or one that tries to capture the middle, or can you do both?
I think it's both. And this is part of why we focus on the squeeze on the middle class, is that the issues that the middle class is facing – are the same issues that those who are poor and who are otherwise trying to work themselves, you know, work their way into the middle class are facing. It's health care. It's the availability and accessibility of quality education. It's good jobs with protections. I mean, these are the issues that unite everyone who isn't wealthy. And so instead of shifting our message, I think we need to reach out to those populations that we have ignored who have a common struggle.
Okay, but here's what they say. I mean, I've talked to middle-class Republicans. I'm sure you have, too. I've talked with all kinds of people. And here's what they say. They say, look, I worked hard to get what I have, what little bit I own. They seem to recognize implicitly that they're working harder to get less far. Maybe they realize that subconsciously. But they say, I've worked hard for this. I don't want to give my tax money away so that some, you know, poor person in the ghetto that's not working at all gets my welfare money. And that argument, first made by Ronald Reagan, pretty tough in the 80s, I still hear that resonate today. You know, I don't want any government help. I'm going to be on my own just fine, thank you. And so I'm voting Republican. How would you respond to a voter like that?
Well, I think, you know, I would say to that voter that I'm sure that you also want good roads, and I'm sure that you want to have good public schools in your neighborhood, and I'm sure that you want to be able to send your kid to college. And those issues are the same issues that unite everyone who's trying to live the American dream in this country. And so we need to make accessible to everyone what's accessible, you know, to you. I mean, are we going to be able to counter, you know, the perception of, you know, the welfare queen? I'm not sure that we can, but I think we can talk about the 2 in 5 African-American and Latino children who can't go to college because of cost.
One of the things I've also focused on is the welfare kings, if you will. I think Halliburton's a prime welfare king, someone who's getting a no-bid contract. That's just welfare. I mean, if you're not bidding to get the best price, we're spending billions of dollars on these huge corporations. And I think that people need to understand just the amounts we're talking about here, that at least since Bill Clinton's workfare program, the amount of welfare has been going down and down and down, while the amount of corporate welfare has been going up and up. And one of my concerns is, and I see it all the time in Washington, D.C., is the homeless population. I recall, and maybe I'm just living in a dream world, but I seem to recall before Ronald Reagan, before the 80s, I didn't remember seeing a lot of homeless people in the streets. It seems to me that either they're more and more or at least the same number, and that unless, you know, they're carted off to prison, which costs a lot more than feeding them and sheltering them, I mean, are Americans becoming more callous to the poor, to homeless people, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there is a way of measuring that. I think that, you know, to some extent we have been fairly successful in hiding some of it. I mean, one of the maps that I thought was very interesting after the election was one that showed how red and blue states went, but by population concentration.
Right.
And you saw that the more concentrated the area, the more blue those places went. And,
sure. I mean, in many ways, the red-blue state divide is it's a city-rural divide. I mean, that's really the best way to describe it. I mean, in Tennessee and Georgia, Nashville and Atlanta went for the Democrats, and yet in upstate New York and rural California, it went for the Republicans. So it's not so much north versus south as it is rural versus urban.
Yeah, and I've heard, you know, the theory, you know, a friend of mine said, I mean, obviously there's a connection between your ability to interact with people and to see difference and to, you know, walk by people that are living in poverty instead of kind of driving through parking lots to go from one place, you know, to the other, and that's your main interaction with other people. And I think there's something to that. I think there's something to, you know, the way in which people have to interact with others that helps, you know, cement their understanding of the world and then their support for policies, you know, that determine other people's lives and chances. So I think there is something, you know, to that approach.
Well, it makes me wonder how much of it is economic at all. It seems to me that in the cities you have more diverse populations, diverse in every which way, diverse in matters of race, sexual orientation, socioeconomic levels, high and low religious diversity, and you meet people of different walks of life, and perhaps that does make you a bit more compassionate, whereas we find in rural and suburban areas tend to be much more, you know, homogeneous, one population, whether it be white or black or of one certain. So even poor people in farms are living among other poor people in farms out in rural places and don't have the chance to really see other walks of life. I'm wondering if that might account for voting even more than poverty and levels of wealth.
Well, I think it's possible, and I think that we need to understand that better. And we meaning, you know, those on the left that are trying to, you know, offer a different vision. But, you know, I think part of this is we're running around, scurrying around, trying to, you know, find a different way of doing things. We've got all of these organizations, including some of our fellow think tanks, holding extensive conferences on, you know, how to talk about religious values and, you know, how to talk about moral values. And, you know, I think we just have to keep talking about the issues that we know define us. And I think that we will get through. We've done this before in this country. The message about economic fairness being a moral value has resonated before. It wasn't automatic. We had to make the case. And then when we did, cooperation between the labor movement, between government, between the private sector, left us with greater chances with what we now, you know, assume is true, the American dream. I mean, that's what it helped to create. And I think we need to go back to that message, and we need to stick to it and be patient.
I think that's a solid point. I think that people don't often – Bill Clinton, in fact, I think does it best, citing the Bible, remembering that certainly Jesus cared a lot more about poor people than he did about stopping stem cell research or stopping gay people or the other things that the right seems to be focused on. Most of his message was caring for the poor, caring for the widow, the orphan. We see that in Judaism and Islam and all kinds of religions. There is a religious message here. It's certainly one that Martin Luther King would bring out, and it would be nice to bring communities together on the religious values of caring for your fellow human being. We have to go to another commercial. If you want to call Foreign Policy in 2004, what is it that makes this year different from all others with regard to Iraq or secrecy of the government, torture, those kinds of questions in 2004, what we can look forward to in 2005. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Like an outer space alien from a 1950s science fiction, allowed high-tech corporations to import hundreds of thousands of low-paid computer engineers, programmers, and other skilled professionals from abroad, rather than paying the middle-class salaries earned by high-tech workers in America. These visas have been a primary tool used by CEOs to bust the salary levels of high-tech jobs, the very jobs that we were told were to be the source of upward mobility and middle-class opportunity for our citizens. At the height of the high-tech boom, greed-headed corporate executives wailed that they simply could not find enough Americans with a computer skill. So it was imperative, they said, that they be allowed to bring in tech workers from India, Russia, and elsewhere to fill the gap. This was pure horse hockey. Far from a shortage of qualified U.S. workers, people with top-notch skills were practically begging for jobs and being rejected. The industry executives were creating a false crisis for one reason. They wanted to displace well-paid Americans with foreign workers who would take a third or less in pay. But horse hockey prevailed. With their campaign contributions and lobbying clout, they got Congress to triple the number of their foreign replacements. Then came the high-tech bust, and hordes of workers of all nationalities were dumped by the CEOs. The H-1B visa levels were no longer an issue and were quietly dropped. Americans, the CEOs are wailing the same old tune about shortages, demanding that Congress give them more H-1B visas to import. 06-528-6264.
I'm just a cowboy who's got achy knees, and the joint pain they call osteoarthritis. I tried over-the-counter pills, they weren't right for me. So I tried some prescriptions, and they made me foggy. And that's when I found you, Celebrex, for joint pain relief, no more, no less.
Celebrex targets the source of pain and inflammation. It's non-narcotic. It doesn't make you foggy or slow you down. Ask your doctor about Celebrex celecoxib capsules. Celebrex should not be taken if you've had aspirin-sensitive asthma or allergic reaction due to aspirin or other arthritis medicines or certain drugs called sulfonamides. In rare cases, serious stomach problems such as bleeding can occur without warning. Tell your doctor if you have kidney or liver problems. To learn more, call 1-888-CELEBREX, visit Celebrex.com, or see our ad in Real Simple. Just one prescription Celebrex gives 24 hours
less.
I'm
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We've got just a few minutes left with Andrea Batiste, director of the Drum Major Institute, a progressive think tank that's been focusing on some of the problems that middle-class people face in America. And we're doing end of the year here, talking about 2004. 2004 will be remembered for lots of things, certainly the war in Iraq and torture and administration secrecy, but it'll also be remembered for not having enough jobs, for the fact that Americans have fewer jobs today than they did 4 years ago, and they're getting squeezed by the middle class, and that's something that Ms. Schlesinger and her organization has been focusing on. I did want to ask you, though, Ms. Schlesinger, it does seem there's a lot of negative news here. In fact, I've been reading some of my blog entries, and I got a guy who calls himself Victor Republican, and he's saying goodbye to the Democrats and citing statistics showing that Americans are moving to the South and the West, moving to the red states. And when, at which point I get a response by a Democratic listener named Skip, who says, is it goodbye Democrats or goodbye democracy? Neither is a very positive response, whether it's gloating or pessimism. Is there anything that we can say happened good in 2004 or is likely to happen good in the future years?
Absolutely. I mean, what we do in our year in review is highlight things that, you know, were positive over the last. Affordable prescription drugs from Canada. You know, House Democrats got together and made a pledge to, you know, play off of, you know, Gingrich's contract with America to create a new partnership for America's future that is based solely around, you know, how do we strengthen the middle class, which to us means also strengthen efforts, including, you know, trying to give, you know, the children, undocumented children of immigrants, access to higher education. You know, we've got the darling of the Republican Party who was willing to say, you know what, I'm going to make sure that there is funding for stem cell research. So there are definitely things that are happening for the most part on a local level to fill in where the federal government isn't. That is a positive thing for Americans, but what we need to do is leverage that into a larger, you know, demand for policies at the federal level that meet the needs that, you know, most people are concerned about: healthcare, education.
So
good jobs.
Help out, if you would, my progressive listener who is listening to my voice, who, let's say, she voted for Howard Dean in the primary, voted for John Kitt election, was devastated about her country's future. What can she do? You know, just she doesn't have a lot of time. She's got to raise her kids. She's probably got a job as well. What can she do to difference in America still today?
Well, I think, you know, she should continue to be optimistic about, you know, our ability to create a message that resonates, who are able to create change. She should invest and, you know, look at or support organizations that are doing more than just taking care of the victims of bad policy, even though we know that that's necessary, but that are also you're asking me to name my competitors. Let's see, there are several you know, excellent organizations that are out there. The Center for American Progress is doing great work, and they are, you know, a significant institute that you know, is marshaling a lot of energy in support of the Democratic Party. The Century People even are now becoming crippled by debt in a way that really is dictating, you know, what the rest of their financial futures will look like. And so those are three that come to mind right now. You know, but there are certainly others. The Applied Research Center in California is doing some of this work. I encourage people to read George Lakoff's book about framing of issues. And, you know, how we pay attention to messaging. So those are some thoughts.
And where do you see 2005 in terms of poverty, the middle class squeeze? I mean, you have to tell the truth, whether pessimistic or optimistic. Is it getting worse or getting better?
It is getting worse. And if we, you know, continue to evade the issues that matter most to the middle class, making health care more affordable, you know, dealing with outsourcing and otherwise, you know, dealing with our stagnant wages and underemployment. If we continue to avoid those issues, the middle class squeeze will only get worse. But the ownership society and, you know, this debate this year is going to be the stage for a lot of these core discussions.
Ms. Schlesinger, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule and coming here and explaining what you do on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Tomorrow we've got the last show before